Just before I go on to say a few words about the exam, can I just ask you to comment on which part of the course you didn't like? Which aspect of the course you found not so good? I don't want you to tell me which part of the course you found good. I want you to tell me which part of the course you thought could have been better, or something that we didn't do that we should, or something that we did that we shouldn't. Any kind of it's important that we find out from you. You know, it's you can be as open as you like. I won't remember your names for the exam, so. So you would have liked to hear more about, sort of have another session on the EU. That's a really good point. Just to let you know that unfortunately for me, and for those who will follow you next year, this course, the lectures for this course will double next year. Or the contact hours will double next year. So there will be space to accommodate that next year. It was hard this year because it would have been difficult for us to take any other lecture out, if you see what I mean, for this year. But it's a really good point. Thanks for that.
I was just going to say that with the lectures, they're good, but like they're very kind of general. Now, when you get to the essay question, for example, there might be an essay question on Franco and Berlusconi or something like that, and we don't really cover it in the lecture, so for the exam it just kind of throws up in the air like, well, I just kind of, it makes me think that I'm not really too sure what's going to come up. What it, because the lectures are quite general, and for example the essay questions were quite specific, with regards to particular people or something. Just kind of throws it up in the air a bit. So if there's going to be more lectures, maybe cover those people directly a little bit more. Because, for example,
So cover the essay questions more.
Just cover the topics a bit more. Because, for example, there were questions on like Franco and Berlusconi. We didn't really touch on them in the lectures. So.
Right. No, that's that's a fair point. That's a fair point, yeah.
One of the essay questions was why pigs, and I'm assuming, well, I did the question, so I wrote about Portugal, but then that wasn't covered really in many of the lectures. So
well, you didn't really have to include too much on Portugal. I mean, the idea of the question there was why Southern European member states have attracted such bad publicity during the course of the crisis. I wouldn't expect you to go into a lot of detail on Portugal, since, as you correctly said, we haven't really covered it that much here. If you have, it's fine, but I wouldn't expect you to. In the same way that I wouldn't expect you to talk about Ireland, which is very often also grouped under the pigs with a double I acronym, right? Yeah, that's good. Yeah. So you find it was m Right.
It would have been nice to have had, I know obviously you couldn't, but it would have been nice to have had tutorials every week.
Right.
Because like, yeah, because obviously like, as you said, the lecture is quite general, would have been nice to
go into more detail.
go into a little bit more depth.
I think part of the problem, I don't think there is any plan to increase the tutorials, and in a way you're both right. Part of the problem with this course, of course, that we cover three countries. So it is difficult to go well beyond the general in the lecture. And that's why perhaps there is also some distance between the more specific essay questions and the more general nature of the lectures. I think with more lectures, it would be we might be able to introduce some discussion. I'm thinking perhaps for next year to allow some lectures to have discussion built in into them, so that people can have a chance to participate, or perhaps screen a few films that relate to Mediterranean politics. That could be a good idea of you know, getting to familiarize yourself more with sort of persons and the issues. It's a small course in terms of credits and contact time, but it has a very wide coverage. And people in the past have asked, you know, why don't we include Portugal as well? The problem is that then it becomes really very general, and I wouldn't like that to happen. Any more problems? It's really useful that people come up with suggestions, you know, on how we can improve perhaps next year. So you would probably scrap the presentations altogether?
Well, make them smaller at least. Because they can be quite useful to save the people to present something. But I think maybe cut the time that they're doing with that so that there is more time for group discussion.
The problem with presentations is that because quite often people don't do anything, they just wait for someone else to tell them because they're going to have a presentation. So it's kind of a double-edged sword. If you give people a presentation, then they don't concentrate on anything else apart from their week. But then if you don't have presentations at all and you have discussions, then maybe people are more likely to do the reading or whatever because they have nothing else to fall back on. They're not just sitting there listening.
Right.
It's kind of like a double-edged sword.
So you would also scrap the presentations? Individual presentations, yeah?
Yeah. Waited until it was mine to put the work in. Whereas if you know you're going to a tutorial where you don't have the entire hour and someone else is speaking for the entire hour, you've got to contribute.
Right. That's a good point.
Also, to add to that, they don't really add anything to presentations. They're just sort of reiterating either what you said in your lecture or sort of the lecture notes, really.
So you would also go for a discussion and sort of on the spot questions to people who come to the seminars.
I just feel like it's such a topical lecture, it's so topical what's going on at the moment, with all the Italian elections and stuff. It would have been quite good to discuss that, even if it was just about 10 minutes, it would have been quite nice to have done something, because it's so nice to do something that's current.
Right. I think you are all right. Perhaps, do you think that it would have been confusing had I opened up discussion in the lecture? Would people contribute? You seemed a very lively bunch. Or perhaps that's what we. It's not meant to be small.
But it's when you get lecture halls full of 300 people that people don't want to say anything.
Right. But in a lecture of this size, people would contribute, right? Perhaps we can do that. We can open up discussion in the lecture and then have more detailed presentations for the seminar. Right. Yeah.
You couldn't get it in the library for love and money. So if you could have had some articles, it would have pinpointed us a bit better. Obviously, articles are more up to date most of the time.
Right.
You need to churn them out than books.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes with the reading, when it just listed a book, obviously I know you've got to be independent about the reading, but there was no chapters listed, and I was a bit
mm-hmm.
I don't know which bits I'm meant to be looking at.
Right. You found that access to material was difficult?
Yeah, very, because there was always only one copy of one of the books. If you can't get hold of it.
We did try to put everything on a short loan time, but it was still hard, right? You see, the problem with not having a presentation is that there is always a danger that the seminar, if people don't contribute, becomes a second lecture. And that's what always worries us. I mean, I don't mind if it becomes a second lecture, but we don't always get people who lead these seminars that are comfortable discussing in an open-ended manner all of the topics. And that's fair enough as well, because we cannot provide expertise at the tutorial level that compares with your lectures, right? I mean, the best thing would have been for me to do the tutorials, but this is not always possible either.
Mm-hmm. And then you have to answer a question and bring in a piece of work. You're not marked on the work, but it's to prove that you've done it, so that you can contribute to the tutorial,
right,
which is more specific.
So you actually write something every week?
Yeah, or you're given a set of questions, and you have to write something, and it doesn't have to be great, but to prove that you've done the reading, and then
right,
you have a plan or something.
Yeah. Right.
That
sounds
very, very small about, but it meant that you had to do
this. Mm-hmm. That's a good point. That's a good point. Well, we've got great ideas. As I said before, it's part of the problem with particularly this course is that so much is going on every year. I mean, this year alone we had two elections. Last year we had three elections. So things change very rapidly. It is impossible for the bibliography to keep up with it, even for journal articles. I mean, I try to account for some of that in the lecture, but I think it's inevitable that people will have to do reading independently of the reading list. I think that's the only way to keep up with it, and perhaps I take the point that we need to allow for more time for discussion and more interactivity, and perhaps the lecture can be structured in a way that would do that. And then at least you feel that you get discussion with two separate people in the context of the course, and that would be better, right? Okay, thanks very much. If anybody has any other suggestions or comments and so on, do email me, because it's important that I hear from you. You know, this course is the only one of its type in the UK. There is no other university that teaches Mediterranean politics as a sort of separate module, right? And it's difficult to have comparators. There are, of course, many courses on comparative politics, but nothing with a specific focus on Southern Europe. So it's also for this reason that we struggle to find textbooks that deal with, you know, there are textbooks on Spanish politics or on Italian politics. There is no textbook on Greek politics, for example. Or there is no textbook in a comparative that deals with Southern Europe comparatively. These are all limitations, and we need to think really how to how to improve it. But thanks for that. It's really helpful. On the positive side, the exam will be very easy. The exam will have two questions for you to answer one. No, that's not true. The exam will have five questions for you to answer one, right? It will have five questions for you to answer one. And three of the questions of the exam will be country-specific. So there will be a question on Greece, a question on Italy, a question on Spain. And two of them will be comparative. And you can choose whichever ones you want. It doesn't matter if you choose a single country or a comparative one. Some people prefer to do comparative reading that has broader coverage. Others prefer to concentrate on a single country or a single issue. If I was to say to you, if you were putting this exam together, which would be the two questions that you would put on Greece, for example? From everything we discussed about Greek politics, and also in the lectures and the seminars, which two kind of issues, questions, you think would ought to feature in the exam? Why EU membership has caused controversy? Yes. That's right. Yeah. That will definitely be something that I think you ought to revise. It's an important topic, right? What other aspect of Greek politics caught your attention? Any the rise of or charismatic leaders in Greece. Both relevant for the exam. There will not be an exam question on Golden Dawn because simply there is not enough bibliography. You cannot really answer it unless you go out and do your own independent research. And for that matter, there won't be a specific question on political parties. What often features in exams of this course are comparative questions on political parties, asking people to compare two, perhaps, political parties of the same party family. So look at the far right in Greece and Italy, or Greece and Spain, or choose any right-wing party in the three countries to any two right-wing parties in the three countries to compare, right? So there will, and that will also touch upon issues of charismatic leadership and so on. So I think that's definitely something that you need to revise on. Pick up a few parties that catch your attention, including Golden Dawn, if you want to do some independent reading. That's absolutely fine. Try and and try to compare them. Perhaps that sounds like a good plan. Anything else on Greece that you thought was kind of interesting or important? Right. Mm-hmm. That is an important topic. It normally features in exam, but not this year. It may be relevant for you to revise this topic because the kind of the foreign policy, the discussion on Greek foreign policy may be introduced on different types of questions that may come up in the exam. But there won't be an exam question on Greek foreign policy. What is worth revising on the Greek case is the transition to democracy. That is a topic that I often like to put in the exam, and you can see that from past exam papers. I'm not telling you any massive secret. I always like the idea of people coming up with some answers on why, for example, transition to democracy in Greece was different to that of Spain. We talked about Greece being a more abrupt transition to democracy with the collapse of the former dictatorship, whereas in Spain being a little bit more negotiated and gradual, right? So something on the topic of transition to democracy is a useful revision for you, particularly in a comparative context. I will not ask you in the exam specific details about how the Spanish transition to democracy was engineered or the Greek transition to democracy took place, but at a macro level, at a comparative level, it's something that is worth revising, right? So, yes?
Just to clarify, if we did the Spanish transition to democracy as an essay, does that mean that we can't answer that question?
If it is comparative, you can.
Oh, okay.
If it is only on Spain, you can't. Right? So, we do not allow you to answer exam questions that are a complete overlap with the essay title. So, for example, if you've written an essay about Berlusconi, you can still compare Forza Italia or the People of Freedom with another right-wing party in Greece, say, or in Spain. Okay. So, something on EU membership. Also useful to be able to connect it with the current crisis, because that's something that is naturally important for this year's exam. Something on the Greek transition to democracy is relevant, and political parties or any political party in Greece that you thought is an interesting phenomenon. Okay. When it comes to Spain, which kind of topics you think ought to feature in the exam? Sorry?
Regionalism,
yes, that's something that normally features in the exam. Not always, but normally features. It's an important topic for Spanish politics, and there is a lot of bibliography for you to look at, and more recent developments, of course, for you to research independently online or through newspapers. So, yeah, regionalism is an important one. We talked already about the Spanish transition to democracy, which is also an interesting topic. Anything else that you thought might be relevant in Spain? Regionalism, transition to democracy.
Impact on the EU, maybe?
Impact on the EU, yeah. I think that's... that's an important one. I can tell you now that there will not be a question on the EU which is specific to a single country. So it is, I think, a topic that makes a lot more sense to study comparatively, right? Again, comparisons between Italy and Spain or Greece, Italy and Spain or Greece and Italy and so on. May be relevant. I would probably revise comparatively with all three countries. I think it will make more sense. You'll be able to build a better exam question, I think. An exam answer, rather. What about Italy? What do you think it's an interesting exam question for Italy? Or interesting topics from Italian politics. The Berlusconi phenomenon, yeah, that's something that features. It often features independently as a single question. More often, it features comparatively in the questions about comparing different political parties across Southern Europe. The impact of Berlusconi, of course, it's also relevant with the current Italian, to the current Italian election, which I want you to revise on. You don't need to go into a lot of detail, but something on the significance of the last Italian election may be relevant here, right? Another issue that we have often put in the exam before is the design of the Italian constitution and linking it to recent Italian history after the Second World War. I think that's something that, you know, we talked about Italy often being labeled as an ungovernable country because the parliament is so strong, because the government is so perhaps weak, because of the party system being the way it is and the different regions having the powers they do. This kind of constitutional design of the Italian Republic, I think it's worth revising, worth knowing about, because it's also something that will help you in the future to understand Italian politics, right? By the way, there may be a new government in Italy in the next couple of days. So that's good. Although we don't know it yet, exactly. We might know the Prime Minister, but it's not entirely clear what will happen. Anything else on Italian politics that you thought?
The collapse of the
First Republic. The collapse of yes, that is that is an important issue. Yeah, I wouldn't revise the collapse of the First Republic as an independent topic, but the collapse of the First Republic is important in answering a question on Berlusconi, for example, or even answering a question on the recent elections, right? Because it's the party system that emerged from the collapse of the First Republic that has come under tremendous pressure in the last Italian election, okay? So, you see, the kind of topics that they are likely to feature are not really that difficult to predict. On the comparative questions, keep the EU membership in mind. Keep the political parties, the comparison between political parties that may be relevant. And also the transition to democracy. I think these three are important. In the past, I have also ask the question about civil society or the quality of democracy in Southern Europe, but very few people answer it. So I think that's causing a lot more trouble to you. But it's an interesting question. You could answer a question like this from everything we talked about in the lectures and the problems about the functioning of democracy in these countries, not so much the fact that they are authoritarian or they are not democratic. They are democratic, but they are democratic, but also have important problems in the way in which the political systems operate. They are not the only ones, of course. There are political major problems in the political system in this country. But some reflection on the quality of democracy in Southern Europe, I think, would be an interesting topic for you to revise. May I suggest something that when you prepare for your revision, never revise specific questions, right? Revise topics, but not questions. My advice to people, and that's something that others may disagree with, but I thought I should share it with you, is that it's better if you revise topics. So, for example, when you discuss about the experience of Greece's membership of the EU, right? Don't try and revise a specific question. It's better to revise the topic and then come up with 10 or 12 bullet points, key arguments that you could make on this topic. And then when you see the exam question, when the exam takes place, try and think of the question. Try then to relate the question to your key points, bullet points, 10 or 12, and then try to expand these points into paragraphs to build up your answer, right? I think that's always a lot easier to do rather than trying to revise in a very restrictive manner specific questions, right? Also, if you are able to revise topics and themes and connect these topics to a number of points that you want to make, you can use various of these various points to build comparative answers or to build any question that may appear in the course, that in the exam, that may surprise you. I don't know, it doesn't work for everybody, but it does work for me, that a revision of topics and then remembering a few key points that then you know you can expand into an answer of three, four pages, you know. I think if you have 10 good points, 10, 12 good points, you would answer very competently the question. Also to remind you, I know that sounds a bit patronizing and annoying, when you answer the questions, always have an introduction and a conclusion, and break down your arguments into paragraphs. I know it's basic, but it is incredible the number of people that answer exam questions and you see text that is like full blocks. It's not broken down. There is no way of establishing, as an examiner, how the arguments flow logically from one another. And there is no evidence of the argument progressing. So make sure that in the introduction of your exam question, or of your exam answer, you say, this is how I understand the question. That's how I'm going to answer it. Okay? Make it clear that the examiner knows, understands how you understood the question. Because different people understand questions in different ways, and that's okay. Huh? But you need to make absolutely clear in the introduction how you go about answering this and explain how you understand the question. And then use your bullet points or any other way you want to do it and break down your answer into paragraphs. And by paragraphs, I mean not more than one third of a page. That's a big paragraph, right? Don't write full blocks of text like it is some sort of a, an old-style newspaper or something, right? It is important that somebody can look through your answer and see the progression of your arguments, right? I guess somebody has told you about this before, but I thought I should remind you of this. Use introductions and conclusions to summarize points, and then use a logically flowing argument or a logically flowing sequence of paragraphs to answer the question. Yeah? Is this clear? Any question, something that you want me perhaps to clarify further? I think that for those of you, because I can now recognize regular faces who've been here for most of the lectures. I think if you've been to the lectures and you've done a reasonable amount of reading, you won't find it difficult to answer the questions. There won't be major surprises, right? But follow the advice today. Make sure that you have a strategy for revision that is not too risky, i.e. I receive emails from people saying, how many topics should I revise? I don't know. The more the better. Don't come to the exam having revised one topic, because it's risky. Sometimes our questions can be slightly unpredictable. That's a Mediterranean politics course. Prepare more, quite a few answers, right? Not only one. Sounds okay? Any points, any questions? Something before, yeah? Coming out of the EU or coming out of the Eurozone? It's two different things. The Eurozone. No, I don't. It's a good question. It won't feature in the exam because it's too speculative. I think that the argument of leaving the Eurozone so that you can devalue your currency and get more tourists to visit Spain or Greece or Italy and recover from there is a childish argument. And it's unsustainable. If any of these countries leave the euro, the prospect has been discussed more explicitly for Greece and in Italy, but in a very peripheral way. But you have to remember that if any currency, any country that is currently member of the Eurozone leaves the Eurozone, the new currency, the new national currency that they will adopt, will be devalued substantially from the euro. People reckon that a national currency for Greece, for example, would probably be devalued by 60% in connection to the euro. What that means is that sounds pretty horrific as it is. Economists will tell you that that's not so bad because then you can export. Because your currency devalues, your products become more competitive, you can sell stuff. But what if you don't have an industry? What if you don't export anything? It is incredible, for example, that Greece is a net importer of food. You would normally associate it with the nice, moderate weather of the Mediterranean and so on. But Greece is a net importer of food, is a net importer of fuel, is completely dependent on imports for fuel. It is completely dependent on imports for medicine. So if the currency devalues by 60%, you might get a few more people at Falliraki or at Corfu or Crete, but the average Joe in the street will probably see the living cost increasing by 30-40%. That's basic products, right? It's not the fact that Mercedes will become more expensive or BMWs will become more expensive. Food will become a lot more expensive. Heating your house may become unaffordably expensive, right? So it's not a way out, particularly for countries that are not exporting nations like the Germans are. And this is where I think, now that's completely irrelevant to the revision, but it's interesting. And I think this is where the Germans got it wrong in the crisis. That in a very evangelical kind of German way, they think that everybody should follow their example and compete globally and basically restructure their economy so they can become exporting nations. But not every nation can be an exporting nation, right? It's a logical fallacy, because if there are some exporting nations, there must be importing nations who buy the stuff. Otherwise, it doesn't work. So to argue that through austerity and reduction of labor costs, these countries will become more competitive because they will export more, it doesn't work like that. They need to become more competitive. This is where the Germans are absolutely right. And they need to spend less. The Germans are also right there. But in order for them to become competitive, there needs to be investment in skills and so on. You can never compete with Bangladesh and India as a European country, right? There is no European political system that will make it possible for labor costs to drop so much so that Spain can compete with China on labor costs alone. They need to compete, of course, globally, but they need to compete on knowledge and productivity and skills and so on. But this requires investment. You cannot improve skills and productivity assuming that you don't want to cut labor costs to the level of Africa or Asia overnight, straight away. That's why austerity is, in a way, necessary to some extent. But if it is too much, it becomes counterproductive, right? Because all that happens is that austerity hits the economy so badly. Take the example of Greece, 1/3 of GDP lost in 3 years, that even healthy companies go out of business because there is no demand. If everybody loses their job, even healthy companies cannot compete. So there are limits. The answer is not to exit the Eurozone. The answer is to make sure that the Eurozone becomes collectively more competitive, right? But for that to happen, there needs to be investment. And the Germans don't want to pay for it, right? That's a trouble. You mean why a possible Greek collapse would...
Why is Spain? Because objectively, when I look at the numbers, Spain doesn't look as bad as Italy and Greece, and I'm wondering why Spain is grouped with Italy and Greece as being a pig.
Because Spain has tremendous problems in its banking sector. The problem in Greece was that of public debt, and in Italy, right? Basically, the state spent too much money. Right, they spend more than they receive in taxes. They had to borrow it. People were not prepared to lend the money. Enter crisis. Okay, the problem in Spain, like in Cyprus, and in Ireland as well, is that there was unsustainable levels of private debt, which is, by the way, also the kind of problem in this country too. That basically people borrow too much money. And as the economy hits difficulties and people lose their jobs and so on, they are not able to service their debts. That becomes even more of a problem when there is a housing bubble, because the biggest item of borrowing that people do is their mortgage, okay? Now, if people start defaulting on the mortgages massively, as it happened in this country in the early 1990s, for example, with repossessions and negative equity and so on and so forth, banks have to register losses in their books, because when debts are not serviced, banks have to write off these debts and account for them in their balance sheets. If that happens to a tremendous extent, as it has happened in Spain, banks run out of money. And when banks run out of money, somebody has to rescue them. There are two ways to do that. If banks run out of money, you lose your deposits. Enter Cyprus, right? Haircuts on people's savings. Or the state steps in and gives money to the banks. It recapitalizes the banks, like it happened in Ireland, right? But when that happens, when the state bails out the bank, what basically follows from that is that private debt, banking debt, or individual debt, then becomes public debt, right? That's why, for example, now Ireland's foreign debt is over 100% of its GDP, because all of the money went to the banks. Why? Because the banks went bust. Why? Because people overborrowed, because they were borrowing a lot of money to sustain a property bubble that eventually collapsed. That's why Spain is seen as a problem, right? The big discussion at the moment is who will pay for the bailing out of the Spanish banks. Will it be the Europeans? The Germans are not so keen. Or will it be the Spanish government? If it is the Spanish government, then the banking debt or the banking problems of Spain will automatically become a hugely increased public debt, meaning that Spain has to go to the markets and find the money. But the markets will be scared because it's too much. On that depressing note, have a good revision, and I hope you enjoyed the course, okay?